These are the Target Files. Journey back with us between the 1970s and 1990s on a TARDIS nostalgia trip as we look back at the novelizations and audiobook releases of classic Doctor Who stories. Accessing Gallifreyan Archives. Subject, Time Lord, known as the Doctor. Subcategory, Earth, Sol 3, Recording of Adventures and Escapades. Subtitle, The Talons of Weng Chiang. Author, Terence Dix. Publication, Earth Year, 1977. Death stalks the fog-bound streets of Victorian London. Young women are going missing. Horribly mutilated bodies are found floating in the Thames. And criminal gangs terrorize the innocent. At the heart of this tangled web sits the mysterious Lee Sen Chang, sorcerer and hypnotist, and his grotesque sidekick, the all-too-lifelike ventriloquist dummy, Mr. Singh. The Doctor dons deerstalker and cape, lurking in the shadows of the metropolis, for the talons of Weng Chiang are reaching out to shred the human race.
This time, the opening time we have regenerated this podcast, you might say. We are looking at The Talons of Weng Chiang, which the TV version was written by the late, great Robert Holmes, adapted for the novelisation by Terence Dix. Your initial thoughts on the book?
Okie dokie. Well, I think it is a stunningly good book. It's well-paced. It just keeps giving as much as every chapter. It's like full romp, brilliant characters. You've got the Doctor being fantastic all the way through it. Leela, his sidekick, is very good. He's very action-prone. It's just a great book, really, from start to finish.
It's sort of layer upon layer of, I think we said about in the past, we have reviewed a John Pertwee story elsewhere lately, The Spearhead from Space, and it was mentioned that is mystery upon mystery, and this I think this takes that concept even further. It's so well layered, it's so well structured, you know, it's just keeps your interest. There is, if you take a general overview, I think there is a lot going on in this story, but it is so well presented, so well layered, that it just keeps your attention throughout. You know, 15 chapters, which is quite long for a Target book, I think, and an audio book, but it does keep your attention.
Well, I managed to do the audio book in one go. That's like, wow. How it keeps your attention. It basically, you don't want to put it down. It's that engaging. It's sort of, you know, you want to know what happens in the next chapter because it's the way. But I agree, there are an awful lot of characters in other people's hands. You might get a bit bogged down thinking, well, why is that character there, what's he doing? Each character has such a good role in it, but they all connect really well.
To be honest with me, it took me a few listenings to really get into the whole scope and what Terence Dix has achieved with the story, because first of all I thought, you know, perhaps it's such a classic on television by Robert Holmes that, you know, perhaps even Terence has met his match here by novelising this. But I think, having listened two or three times, he does get it, the scope. He manages to incorporate that whole scope, he manages to expand on things, but he keeps the essence of what is an excellent story.
Oh yeah, I totally agree, because, you know, it is the start of, you know, is it Philip Hinchcliffe, I will say, probably, one as well as Robert Holmes.
Yes, it's actually Philip Hinchcliffe's last story as producer. He got.
Is it really his last one? Because that would explain why I thought when I was listening to it that it was repeating some of the things they'd done before.
Yeah, there's a documentary on the DVD. The DVD released as part of the Revisitations box set in 2010. Track it down if you can. It's a superb set, along with the television movie and the Caves of Androzani. But there is a specially made documentary from that time called The Last Hurrah, which is as Tom Baker meeting up with Philip Hinchcliffe and discussing this as Philip's last story. And ironically enough, with the title of this new podcast, Philip Hinchcliffe thought and had made plans for the following season, but he was asked to go and produce a TV series called Target, which is funny enough. But yeah, he was taken over by Graham Williams, and he explains in that documentary how this may have been a fallout from the Mary Whitehouse controversy with the Deadly Assassin and various other...
Well, I'm not surprised. There are some pretty things which people probably would have had meltdowns about in it.
Yes, I can only imagine her equivalent nowadays, but thankfully we seem to have a few more serious things in the world to worry about than...
I know.
Kicking up a fuss about those things.
I was saying, probably at the same time, it was still the same sort of political things we have now. The whole point of Doctor Who is a bit of light relief.
That's true, you know, but Britain was probably more sort of insular then, wasn't it, I think?
You know, yeah, more provincial in some bits.
We didn't have the 24-hour news, we didn't have the World Wide Web then, and yes, I think you're right there, more sort of provincial. But, you know, good things about it.
Oh, yeah.
Not so good things about it. Yeah, I agree with that. I'd just like to talk out about the influences of this book. I mean, you can certainly see George Bernard Shaw's Pygmalion.
Oh, definitely, definitely. With the whole sort of relationship between the Doctor, Leela, and Professor Lightfoot. Yeah, where he's all the way through it trying to make her more educated.
Yeah, there's so much good humour with that as well, isn't there? You know, it's really well written. I was trying to think of a specific joke then, but it's gone from my head. But you can track it down, folks, if you have a good listen, and if you have a...
Well, there's plenty there. There's plenty of way for the, that is one thing about this book, though. It's lots of good humour.
Yeah, and actually Louise Jameson says on that same documentary on the DVD how Leela isn't well-educated, but she is fiercely intelligent. I think that is... You know, streetwise is the word that came to mind for me. Very adept at fitting into any situation, really, isn't he? I mean, it's played with in humour in this book in terms of the eating scene. You know, when she is she's so happy to see a carving knife, isn't she? And she really goes for the chicken or the beef with it. In is it Jago or Lightfoot's house?
It's at Lightfoot, and he sort of feels self-conscious, so he does the same with the ham.
Yeah, it's a very sort of polite British way, isn't it, of not showing your superiority, I think, is the
yes.
is the phrase by... just being polite and kind, really, and then she overturns all that good work by wiping her fingers on the tablecloth.
Yes.
Eddie's sort of very gentle again with that, isn't he?
It's a great... I think those sort of bits work really well with Jacob and Lightfoot. Lightfoot is trying to do the educational bit to Jacob because he thinks he's a bit bluff and a bit lower down as a person who runs a music hall.
Yeah, I mean, the relationship between those two, it has developed now. How many is it? Sort of 8 or 9 series?
I think we're in, just come out last week, is the 11th series
of that. Yeah, 11th now, wow.
The absolutely amazing Jacob and Lightfoot, which is well worth spending money on because it is just brilliant.
I mean, you can see back in the day if they had the sort of, I don't know, the budget now, the opportunities for multi-channel TV, they would have had a spin-off if they had been created now, I think, on television. You know, they've had this spin-off
for
Big
Finish.
That's
what I was going to ask you, because I can't remember. In the TV version, are they actually in it a lot?
Yeah, quite often, I'd say. I'd say most episodes. They do have some sort of key moments to move the narrative along, don't they? You know, and the conversation with them is sort of very old-fashioned, well-played, isn't it? You know, very Victorian. You know, that stands
out. I just wonder, because they've always mentioned how, you know, when they do interviews these days, they're going, oh, we did like 2 days' worth of work, and then we thought that'd be it, basically.
Perhaps you're right there. If listeners could let us know at the Target Files, our new Twitter handle, which is coming up shortly.
You search for on Facebook Doctor Who the Target Files, and that will find the page.
Yeah, I think those two. It's just a case of them being so well written. They seem to have a great part in the story, don't they? You know.
Although, in a sense, I think they actually do more work than the Doctor in this book.
I think so. I would agree with that, and they are. Just so well written, so well performed by... Right, I've got to get this right. Christopher Benjamin, Trevor Baxter?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah, so well performed, those two. It's wonderful. Talking about other influences, It also has been mentioned the Phantom of the Opera with a whole Magnus Greil unveiling.
Oh yes, yes, definitely.
Would you say that in without the romance element? Obviously, that yeah, between sort of Mr. Sin, you know, it's not really love, is it? It's sort of blind duty, isn't it? You know, but with the whole unveiling and Lily using the unfortunate phrase, which would probably wouldn't be PC nowadays, bent face. That's rather unfortunate. But what do you feel of Magnus Greil? I feel he treads the line between being a very sort of whiny villain who you feel absolutely no sympathy for.
I have to admit, I felt more sympathy and thought was a better villain was Wee Chan Chen, where Magnus Creed is just a bit, oh, I'm dying, I'm not well, yes, get me more people to eat and kill. I just didn't really get him, basically. He's not the greatest villain.
No, you know, I want your life force, isn't it? And yeah, Lee Sen Cheng is so much more tragic, I think, isn't it, you know?
Yeah, and he's more, you know, sort of more, there's some great bits where, you know, he's stalking around London looking for the girls to give back, and they're really dark and vicious, and, you know, he's got more of menace.
Yeah, speaking of the girls, actually, that's one of the big changes in the novelisation, is the girls kidnapped are portrayed as, one is portrayed as a waitress, whereas in the television show, she's a prostitute.
What a surprise.
Yeah, I mean, do you think it's because this book was aimed at children, or...
Probably yes. Well, you know, it's got quite adult content to it, though.
That is sort of quite a change, really, when you think in the opposite direction if a book is ever adapted for television. You'd suggest that would almost occur the other way around, wouldn't you?
Yeah, you'd think it'd be the other way around.
Do you think that adds to the story, the whole... Do you think that adds or takes anything away?
I personally thought, though it's not set his way, I thought she was, you know, a prostitute. That's what I always thought they were.
Laid up, isn't it? You know, even in the text of Terence saying... he was looking for ladies of the night, Lee Sen Chen, and it's all sort of laboured towards
that.
He
goes to that sort of bawdy house, which you can tell is definitely a brothel, looking for women. So I automatically thought it was that, basically.
Absolutely, Al. And the other sort of major influence, you might say, are the Fu Manchu tales.
Oh, yes. I was going to mention how, unfortunately, it does have a very stereotype of Chinese people in this book, unfortunately.
Oh, yeah, Chinese right down to, I think, John Gray plays Lee Sen Cheng. He's actually a British actor, sort of made up to look oriental, look, is the phrase you'd use, but not very PC nowadays. But, you know, people actually mention that it was a pastiche of those stereotypes. You know, does it ever cross a line for you?
I don't know, because all the way through the book, it's like, oh, the pigtails and all the sort of makeup to make me look more Chinese. I thought it was a bit, it did have that feel in the book that it was very stereotyped Chinese, basically.
Yes, and you know, Jago or Lightfoot has a conversation with the doctor, and the doctor says, when they've been mugged, and the doctor says, well, of course, they're Chinese hoodlums, you know. that seems rather strong.
There's a definite feel in the book between, you know, the British are best. You know, when the doctor's about to, you know, he's in the boat with Jake Lightfoot in the sewers, and he's got the gun, he goes, oh, well, that gun will obliterate you if you shoot. And he goes, no, it won't, it's British.
Yes, you know, sort of quite faux pomposity, really, isn't it? You know, the way it's written, but it was stereotyping an attitude at that time. I mean, you know, whether it was the attitude of the media at that time,
very stereotyped films.
Holmesian as well, isn't it? You know, we have the Doctor and the Deerstalker. Tom later went on to play the Doctor in A Hound of the Baskervilles.
That's great.
Adaptation, yeah, from 1982, I think. But, you know, did you like the whole music hall variety setting as well? Did that add something to it? You know, sort of mystery of being in a theatre?
Well, I think so, because it adds, you know, sort of, everybody thinks that, you know, it's the whole theory of, your, you know, is this a play on play, basically? Because, you're, you know, people go to the theatre expecting to, you know, have some relief and fantasy, and they get there and the whole fantasy sort of turned on its head, really.
Yeah, the opening scene is so well written as well and described, isn't it? It's all about... There's a one line Terence puts in about everybody came to the theatre, no matter what background, to escape their woes. You know, sort of,
yeah, totally. And great, the whole thing about the gods leveler in that first bit, you know, where if you couldn't afford it, you went up into the gods.
Yes, the great leveller of the theatre, really, isn't it? The great leveller of entertainment. We can all watch it. We can all experience it.
And maybe get some... Everybody watches it, everybody gets something different from it.
Very true, very true, Al. Give us one. Yeah, I've got the chapter titles here, Al. They're very evocative and simple, really. The first one, for instance, The Terror in the Fog, Ghost of the Horror in the River... The last few, chapter 13, The House of the Dragon. 15, The Firebomb.
It's basically tells you exactly what's going to happen. So I expect when Terence laid this book out, he basically did the chapters first and probably wrote the text round the chapters, I think. Yeah.
In the Jaws of the Rat. You know, that's a...
It's a great one.
Got to speak about that rat as well. You know, how do you felt it came across on TV and in this book, Al?
Well, from my memories on TV, I don't think it was that great, but actually in the book, it's really sort of slow build up. You know, you see it, you hear it, and then you've got that bit where it's holding onto Leela and the doctor doesn't know if to shoot it or not, and then blows it to Kingdom Come, and it's great, I think, in the book.
Yeah, I'd absolutely agree with that. You know, there's a lot of tension there, isn't it, down in the sewer?
I believe when they filmed that, that's what gave... Is it mentioned in the thing you've seen? Is it where Louis Jameson mentions he got flu because of being so cold in those sewers?
Yes, yes, and they filmed down at Wapping as well, I think, for fishing the body out of the river early on.
Apparently you can go on a new walk in London where you can actually go to all those bits.
Oh, fantastic. Especially created Doctor Who one, is it?
Yeah, so it's Doctor Who walk, what includes all the bits from Talons of Wen Chang where they filmed it, basically.
Yeah, I think I'll have to check that out, Al, if we can at some point.
I find out all this news for the old Who's News app.
Oh, so have a look at that online, folks. That's a good
definitely
source.
It's a very well-used piece of app. It basically gives you notification on anything Doctor Who-wise, so it's brilliant, basically.
And I'm also looking for further information on the novelisation at tardis.wikia.com. It's got a specific page for each novelisation of the story.
I use that site. I'm trying to think that the chapters are brilliant because they basically, if you just look at the chapters, you'd know exactly what the book's about, I think.
Exactly, I'd agree, Al. Perhaps moving on to the cover of the novelisation, the initial publication, first published in 1977. Have you had a chance to look at the sort of yellow...
What is the cover?
It's sort of yellow-orangey background. Li Sen Cheng, the giant rat, appear behind the Doctor's left shoulder in almost a kaleidoscope, really. Tom is there in his Deerstalker outfit, and he's also holding a shotgun, which is probably quite unusual for a Doctor Who cover, I think.
Yeah, because you think the whole policy of no violence, but I think that's quite a good cover, actually. That sort of tells you exactly what's going to happen. You'd want to pick that up, I think.
Yeah, I'm just going to have a look and see if there's a few reprints as well.
I'm surprised this one isn't on the most recent reprints.
Very true, very true, I think.
Because it is definitely still to this day a favourite of most people.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think it was the first of Jeff Cummins, I think, was the very first he did for the Target Range, you know, following Chris Achilleos.
Chris Achilleos, the great.
The first cover illustrated by Jeff Cummins, who replaced Chris Achilleos. So, yeah, I think he's done a very good job with that.
I think he's done a very good job, because I think if I saw that on a shelf in Waterstones, I would have wanted to pick it up and see what it's about, because that sort of says, oh, what's the rat? Why is the Doctor, who normally doesn't have guns or, you know, has got a gun in his hand?
This was the last title to be reprinted by Target Books in March 1994, and the last book to carry the Target Books logo on the cover. Bit of history for that one, really.
Yeah, that's interesting, because then we move, because Target, didn't they get sort of merged by Virgin then?
Possibly the New Adventures, wasn't it, Al, I think?
Yeah, New Adventures, all the Virgin stuff. Yes. That's always a very good, interesting thing with the New Adventures. They were much more violent than Target.
Yes, it's quite a... Was it Damaged Goods that Russell wrote?
Damaged Goods is the Russell T. Davis one. That's not too violent. That's quite... deals with more other things, but there are things like Blood Heat, which is full of violence, swearing and stuff you would never get in Doctor Who.
So looking at the covers, Al, there's also another one which I think was in line with the New Adventures. It has the Sylvester McCoy logo, a very red, sort of browny red mauve, I suppose, background.
Yeah.
Just individual art shots of Magnus Greel, Mr. Sin, the Doctor, and the Dragon.
Yeah, the dragon.
Yeah, it's quite sort of vague, really. It's nowhere near, I don't think, as good as the...
I think that's too much overkill. You know, that's giving you too much.
Very true. I would agree with that, Al. Definitely.
I think the first one sort of makes you think, well, why is the... That sort of says, oh, these are all the characters in the book. This is what you're getting. Where the first one sort of says, why? Why is the Doctor on the front cover with a gun in his hand? Why is there a big rat? You know, where this one just says, this is what's happening.
Very true, Al. Very true.
I think I would probably pass... by the reprint.
A US print in September 1979. Black background. Doctor Who symbol I've not really seen before, with a curve between the Doctor and the Who, and a red banner around it. It has a picture of one of the Chinese Tongs, the henchmen, a picture of a small rat on top of a lady's face, one of the either waitresses or prostitutes, and it's all in red background, and it actually has a introduction from Harlan Ellison, saying, "Incomparable, extraordinary, my hero, Doctor Who." So,
well, maybe. I still think the first one's the best one.
I think the first one captures the Britishness. And the sort of gritty, the gritty Victoriana.
I think when I buy books, I like to have a cover that says, "What gives?" Ask you questions, basically.
Yes, the Victoriana, I think, is very much prevalent in the initial book published in 1977. It sort of gives that gritty British Victorian feel, doesn't it?
Yeah, which they have always tried to have with the whole sort of Jacob and Lightfoot reigns in Victoriana. Well, they have played with it quite loose. Well, I think definitely the first cover does most justice to it.
Looking at factoids, what was deviations from the televised story? Doctor explains in the TV version, apparently, a malfunction with the Peking homunculus, which was supposed to be a toy, nearly caused World War VI. In this novel, he claims World War VI did happen, and Magnus Greil created the homunculus himself with that intention of triggering the World War.
Well, either way it works, I suppose.
Yeah, it's not great stuff that deviates away. It's just sort of interesting to look back on,
isn't it?
It's
definitely interesting.
The Doctor also wears his scarf in this version while he's just got the full Sherlock Holmes gear on in the television version. Tom got to have the scarf again.
This is Alex Gibbons' Doctor Who News Round.
It's just been announced that Alistair Pearson will be at the Comic Book Museum on the 4th of June, the last day of the exhibit of the Target novel covers. I think that will be well worth a visit, as he is an important member of the Target family and somebody who deserves looking at his artwork. The big Finnish main news this week is the fabulous 10th Doctor box set that has finally been released as a download and also as a very nice lavish CD box set. We all know there was quite a few problems on Monday when it came out, as it crashed the whole of the Big Finish servers. But if you were lucky enough like me to get around to getting it all to work, then you'll have the excellent three episodes. They're all very different. I know it's causing quite a bit of controversy on Facebook and Twitter, as like with everything, they're not all love, but they are well worth a listen. Also spotted in Cardiff this week was the great John Barrowman, not being Malcolm Merlin from Arrow, but going back to his roots and being the great Captain Jack, seen in his costume at the Doctor Who Experience. So is this going to start the rumours that he's in the Christmas episode? There's also a chance to actually be part of the Doctor Who program for season 9. There is a new trainee role going at BBC Wales Doctor Who, all on the BBC career website, and it's a 10-month contract, which would be a great stepping stone or starting role if you're interested in getting into working in the great BBC. Well, let's also look at the audiobook of Talons of Wen Chang, what was released by BBC Audiobook in 2013, read by Christopher Benjamin.
My initial thoughts are just a great performance. And it's been mentioned, by us before, various places, that the performance, some people give a performance in these audios. Some people, I'm not going to say the word phoned in, but they don't perhaps have the gravitas of others in presenting them in audio, but I think Christopher Benjamin gives really enthusiastic, fast-paced, fast-moving performance that keeps your interest throughout.
I would agree with that on most parts. I think Christopher Benjamin's performance is brilliant, whatever he does, but I think he didn't quite get Tom's voice right. That's the only thing I would nitpick about it.
Tom does stand out in this story on telly, but it's very much an ensemble piece for me.
Definitely, I would agree that it's a really good, it is well worth listening to, because it's got Christopher Benjamin doing what he always does, which is greatness. He does his Jaco fantastically, what he does, and he also, because he's obviously been with Trevor Baxter a lot, does a really good Professor Lightfoot impression. Yeah. I just thought sometimes his women weren't that great. That's the only thing, which is always a hard thing for male actors to do, to be honest.
Leela came across as Leela, really. I did think that. She had the right sort of level of aggression, threatening when she needs to be, but also in a very comedic way as well at times.
I'll definitely listen. I think with me, I always hear Lou James's voice when I hear Leela, basically. But otherwise, I think, yeah, he did a pretty good job on that, I think.
Yeah, I mean, considering Leela is sort of joked about as the savage, isn't she, and her joked about for her outfit at times. You know, I think she is a very well-rounded...
Oh, almost definitely. She's definitely the... I'd say she's definitely the most sort of, you know, feminist character after Sarah, you know, after Sarah Jane, basically.
How much sort of development would you see for a character across the series?
Well, in TV land, it sort of did slowly develop, but we've had a lot more development for her character since Big Finish days, you know, with the new Fourth Doctor stuff that's around at the moment. Her character has really developed into something much more rounded and more sort of her own person. But I think there was more to do, unfortunately, with the costume what Lou Jameson had in Doctor Who, you know, the TV. It sort of automatically made you not think about her own character, I think, sometimes.
I think so, and I think we have mentioned, and we will get to it at some point in this review, the invasion of time, and she goes off with a... It was described in the past as a wet fish. The gentleman she goes off
definitely.
With. It's another situation like Susan, where you don't think they would be the greatest couple to stay together, but, you know, in literary terms, but, you know, opposites attract.
You never know.
Bravery in different forms, intelligence in different forms. You know, as we said before, Louise Jameson herself says she's not well-educated Leela, but she is fiercely intelligent and streetwise.
She's just great all round, Leela, but I think in the TV stuff, her character didn't have enough time to develop, I think.
Yeah, there was apparently a bit of a co-relationship between her and Tom. You know, Tom has said now they've become great friends now. In subsequent decades. But
well, I believe it's due to her that we have all the new Tom Big stuff through Big Finish.
Yes, if you could elaborate on that, Alan, in case listeners don't know.
Well, in case listeners don't know, we now have had, like, the season 5 of Big Finish, hundreds of lovely new Tom Baker recordings with Lou Jameson, Lala Ward. Basically, what happened is that Lou Jameson, who worked with Big Finish on different things, gave Nick Briggs, the executive producer, Mr. Dalek voice, his email address, and he sort of politely emailed Tom Baker, and I think it went for a large lunch, and eventually got Tom Baker to work for Big Finish, and it's been brilliant ever since.
Hooray for Lou. Love her.
Indeed.
Brilliant. Absolutely love her.
He's just fantastic.
So, production-wise, did you like the sound editing and everything on the audio, Al?
Oh, I thought the sound editing was really good. It had all the sort of good special effects in the background.
Yeah, the sort of very mysterious noises and tunes throughout you get played, don't you? And Dr. Matthew Sweet did a documentary in the 50th anniversary year called Me, You and Dr.
Yeah, he did. I thought that was really interesting, that was.
He spoke to Dudley Simpson at this time, and Dudley Simpson managed to recreate an orchestra, didn't we, for one of the cliffhangers when... is it the moment when the horse and cart pulls away at the end of one of the episodes?
Yeah, that one.
Yeah, and he managed to create, with only 6 instruments, the sound of an orchestra. And Matthew Sweet actually recreates that on the documentary. If you can track it down, folks, I know it's been repeated on Watcher in the UK, trying to encourage people to track things down legally if they can. But
definitely, probably on YouTube as well. I think W has had it on.
Possibly, yeah. W has had it on. It may be repeated by the BBC at some point. It would be nice to get a DVD release, probably to do with rights and all the clips they use. But
it would be nice, because I know when they bought the 50th anniversary, it didn't have much of the extra things on, did it?
No, it was missing that, wasn't it? It really was. But yeah, you might be able to find them somewhere. I wouldn't encourage it, but there we are. So yeah, we have left on this new podcast the overall thoughts. To the end, really, we gave a little teaser what we both thought at the beginning. I think we both thoroughly enjoyed this. Alex, your general overview thoughts, your final thoughts on this book, and your score, please.
Well, as I said, I think it's excellently written. The book is great paced. It's got action all the way through it. You won't be able to put it down. It's such a fun romp. As Jaco would say, it's a corks all the way through it. So I would give it... as a score, probably a 10, I think, because I can't really fault much in it, to be honest.
Yes, Al, you know, I was pondering, my thoughts are, the first time I read it, it took me a little while to get into it. Amazing how things change. I did initially have that thought, I mentioned it earlier on in the podcast, has Terence bitten off more that he can chew with this book? But having got into it a few chapters in, No, he hasn't. He's expanded on it. He's taken the work of the great Robert Holmes and made it even better for me. Fast moving, as you said, Al. Great chapter titles. Brilliantly read by Chris Benjamin. Keeps your attention. Really brings the characters off the page again. Yes, we have the TV version of these Doctor Who stories, most of them. But yeah, he also adds so much depth as well. So much background, which manages the balance between keeping your interest and keeping the pace of the narrative and the story along. So yes, 10 from me. Perfect 10 as well. Good start to the target. Good start to the Target Files. They got a lot to live up to now, Al.
Next time, the Target Files. We'll be discussing Doctor Who and the Visitation, written by Eric Saywood, along with the audiobook performed by Matthew Waterhouse. The Target Files, a Doctor Who podcast, featured Alexander Gibbons and Michael Wilkes. Title and incidental music originally composed by Murray Gold and Dudley Simpson. Opening and closing podcast arrangement by YouTube user GruelingTerror42. News round, opening and end themes composed by Ted Heath and his orchestra and John Baker. No copyright infringement intended. Target Files, Talons of When Chiang was recorded in Exeter, Devon, UK, and Swansea, Wales, UK, during May 2016.